Hi guys, welcome back to this week's episode of Millennial Mirrors. On this week's episode, the topic is, how do people define you? Our guest is Sarah Al-Agroubi, who is an Emirati multidisciplinary artist who explores the notions of culture and identity of both the Middle East and Western cultures. She's the founder of the Letters Project, even though since then we recorded this episode pre-COVID. She is now no longer in charge of it. There's a whole team managing it, so just kind of a disclaimer there for you guys. She's also the co-curator of Banat Collective, a creative community that discusses intersectionality, feminism, gender, and identity politics from a Middle Eastern perspective. So she's got quite a lot of interesting stuff going on. Listen in, and hopefully you'll enjoy it. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for taking the time. Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So, tell me the story of Sarah Al-Agroubi.
What part of Sarah Al-Agroubi do you want to know?
I don't know. Pick the story you want to tell.
Wow, the pressure's on already and we haven't even been 30 seconds into this podcast.
I know, right?
I think I could start and say, you know, I'm Sarah. I was born and raised in Brussels. I'm an artist. I live in the UAE. I grew up all over the world. I'm often at times a black sheep of the herd. Mm-hmm. I feel often that I'm always caught between the midpoint of something, whether it's the duality of culture, the duality of identity, the duality of whatnot. So I would always, self-identify as just an artist that's living my life.
And you are half Emirati, half
Syrian.
And is that why you think there's so much duality in your life?
Definitely. Like I said, struggling with this idea or this notion of like a duality growing up. It was interesting growing up in the West, knowing that cultural identity or the cultural fabric that you belong to isn't necessarily at the forefront of your identity. People don't care very much where you're from and your background. And in Brussels, they very much advocate for mixes. Mm-hmm. So when I kind of came in, I always self-identified as half Emirati, half Syrian. And so when I came back to the UAE, that's when the pressure cracked down and people started to tell me or define me in a way that suited their understanding of what an Emirati should, could, or would look like, or act like, or sound like. And for me, that was just such a point of, like, there was serious, like, cognitive dissonance that took place for me after that happened. And I was just like, but I'm going to be me. I don't need somebody to tell me how I need to be. So,
and how did you kind of react? In the day-to-day, how does that, like, manifest as a reaction, I guess?
Well, it depends. I mean, you know, when it comes to identity or identity politics as a whole, it ebbs and flows. You know, mm-hmm. it's you can have a range of facing microaggressions on a day-to-day basis, or you can be confronted with people that are like-minded individuals that create a sort of an awareness to you, so you have a point to connect with them on. But for me, it was very much I grew up being othered by the Western community. And then when I came back here, I was othered by my own community. So there was a lot of otherness that was going on. And I had to find a place that I could exist. So I created a place for me to exist.
And is that place the black sheep place?
Yeah. And I think maybe black sheep might not be the right term, but it's definitely, it's me. It's where I belong, and I don't need it. There's no rules or restrictions that I, you know, take in that regard. I just exist as I so please.
I like black sheep. Personally, mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of like black sheep. Mm-hmm. Most of my friends tend to be black sheep of their families. And I myself, some would say, am the black sheep. But I think it's one of those things where it used to be this kind of there used to be such a bad connotation because needing to belong mm-hmm. and having to belong in a society was so important for your survival, for just kind of, I mean, that's how
Definitely.
The world worked.
Yeah.
Whereas now I feel like stepping into your own kind of identity in your own space is something which allows you to do so much more and be so much more. And so, I don't know, I don't think it's as bad as it used to be.
Yeah, and it also depends on who made the rules to begin with.
Yeah.
So, for example, you know, there are various societies that encourage this idea of quote unquote authenticity. And I put it in quotations because you don't necessarily have to be a black sheep in order to be authentic. And then they're not antithetical to one another. Yeah. But for example, when it comes to a community that kind of advocates for two types of the way that you can look at identity politics. So one, it's a kind of a twofold answer that I've created for myself, right? Just now. But one is that you kind of draw a larger circle around a community and you find the thing that unites you. So it would be like, we all bleed the same way. We all have troubles and trials and tribulations. But then the other fold is that you draw that same large circle around a community and you identify a common enemy. And then that becomes the things that unites you. So one unites a common bond of various kind of like threads or fabrics within your identity. So like I said, you know, we all bleed the same way, whatnot. And then the other one is that you use a division and that is what unites you. And so I think within the region, we have almost a split personality when it comes to that. People enjoy being the sort of homogenous fold of like, oh, we are all of the same ilk. We all woven from the same fabric.
Right.
But then they also enjoy this idea of like, let's unite and have a common enemy that we can all agree and, you know, like exist with
to fight. Yeah,
exactly.
It's interesting because, I mean, one of the things that I sometimes get criticized for this podcast is that I only look at the negatives of our culture, which I don't agree with at all. And I always used to end the episodes with what's the part of your culture that you always carry with you. And so many people, the answer to that would be hospitality. Because like here in the Middle East, hospitality is just something you're so trained and it's like such a big part of you. And it's interesting that like I had people that are so, so different. But no matter how different they are as people, that one thing was always like the thing that would come out as the answer because
Definitely.
We're just so kind of trained into it.
Definitely. But I think also it can be a blessing and a curse because I think that when people are overly hospitable, they ignore maybe telltale signs where people can take advantage of that hospitality or you tend to feel like it's this notion of like, I mean, I always say it's like keeping up with the Joneses, but in this region, it's like keeping up with the Shamsis or keeping up with the whatever.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
I think it's, you know, I think when it comes to identity or like self-actualization or addressing yourself in whatever manner you see fit, I think within the given community that we belong to, there's almost like a set rule and you either fall within that bracket. So I had this experience, which is, it was a really kind of, it really cemented my understanding of where I sit within that threshold. And I remember I was being interviewed at one point in my art career, this was several years ago. And I started having a conversation with this person because the interview was in Arabic. Mm. And as soon as I started speaking, the project that I'd was working on was about the fact that I was half Emirati.
Right.
And the second I kind of addressed that, the person that interviewed me kind of stopped and said, listen, we don't talk about that. You know, in this kind of context, you are just Emirati. So please, can we just start again?
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
So I kind of like, got myself together and started again. And then within 20 seconds in the interview, he kind of stopped it. And he said, listen, can you change your accent? Because you sound really Syrian. And I think it's really important that you kind of, you know, appeal to the Emirati side of you. And I just went, and this interview is done. And that was the last time I ever gave an interview in Arabic.
Wow.
And that was a few years ago.
Yeah.
And I think that really cemented this kind of awareness of how people kind of operate within the sphere of identity. So
I think that's very interesting. And I think the dismissal of almost like half of your identity, I mean, like, or half of your, let's say, heritage is a bit insane. Is that one of the things that led you to kind of start something like the Letters Project, where you kind of realize that people aren't always going to be able to say what they want to say, how they want to say it. And so giving them.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Well,
first of all, can you tell people what the Letters
Project is? Oh, sure. Yeah, definitely. So the Letters Project, it's thelettersproject.co on Instagram, was born kind of through this this need that I had to use social media as a platform to discuss sociocultural content. Mm-hmm. And often at times I would sit there and kind of unpack or dismantle ideas that I thought were really interesting. And I was often at times getting information sent back to me through followers that mm-hmm. said, you know, oh yeah, I agree, or I echo the same sentiment or whatnot. And then it started in London, and then it turned into this place where people wanted to have like a permanent location where they could read these stories and understand their own experiences and see themselves reflected in my stories. So it turned into this platform where I was like, well, send me a letter. It's anonymous. Mm-hmm. You send a letter through a web link. The web link doesn't ask for any personal details, and you just speak your truth. And then that gets uploaded as a post on Instagram. And what's interesting is that the thing that kind of almost blew up or made the Letters Project blow up was a story that someone wrote about being half Emirati.
Okay.
So that was someone uploaded it onto Twitter that then got retweeted like 900 times and was like, there was thousands of comments on it. And then that led to like this explosion on the Letters Project.
Wow.
So, but the Letters Project is, I mean, the way that I see it is that it just kind of came to me. There's a kind of an anthropologist, somewhat like, I think she's a psychiatrist and a sociologist and an anthropologist, I think, Brené Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote this book called The Power of Vulnerability. And in the book, she discusses that we are very much in a culture of scarcity.
Mm-hmm.
And what she means by that is that we are hyper aware of the lack in our culture. And that could be lack of, you know, I'm not good enough. I'm not rich enough. I'm not placed on the socioeconomical ladder high enough. I'm not mm-hmm. pretty enough. And all of these like self-deprecating, almost imposter syndrome-esque things that take place pushes us within a framework where she argues that people that are in or have this notion of scarcity in their culture know that scarcity thrives in shame-prone cultures. And that is very interesting because that is a direct response to the Letters Project, where a vast majority of the letters do talk about vulnerability and mm-hmm. through shame and through trauma. So I think that was where the kind of Letters Project came to be.
Well, I think the reason why something like the Letters Project would be successful is because of the fact that shame is such a big part of, I mean, a lot of people's existence, not just mm-hmm. in the Middle East, but mm-hmm. I think there are so many kind of rules and regulations on what is and isn't allowed. And sometimes even like the very first episode of Millennial Mirrors was called Abe.
Mm-hmm.
And what is Abe is a moving target,
mm-hmm.
depending on who you are, whether your gender, your socioeconomic background, your nationality, all those things completely shift that target.
Definitely.
And so what might be completely fine in your opinion is definitely not fine in someone else's opinion. And so it becomes this thing where you're always wary to a certain extent, and you're always kind of wondering whether what you're doing is going to bring shame. Because at the end of the day, especially in a collective society, you walk out and you don't only represent yourself, you represent yourself and your family and your extended family, so on and so forth.
Definitely.
So I think something like the Letters Project, where people are holding on to something that they might feel so ashamed about, but they can't necessarily share or live in terms of their truth. It's an amazing escape to almost. To a
definitely.
Certain extent.
I do agree with you in the sense that, you know, the barometer or the by way of measure of what we consider shame is relational, it's mm-hmm. Contextual, and it's individual.
Yep.
But I also think that comes from with the Letters Project, because anonymity is part of the is at the forefront of these letters, it almost eliminates or eradicates any kind of way of marginalizing or underrepresenting or pigeonholing a story, mm-hmm. Because it doesn't have, you don't know the race or the religion or the right. gender of the person. You just know their truth or their experience. And so you see yourself reflected in that story. And what's interesting about the way that the Letters Project is done is that, you know, one letter becomes a triggering point for, or ripple effect to like four different or five different letters, and then the subject matter changes. And so you see this interesting pattern that takes place where like someone will address toxic masculinity and there'll be a wave of like 10 letters about mm-hmm. their experience with that. And I think is another thing that just came to mind is that when it comes to, I think her name is Mary Pfeiffer. She said that, social change is a million acts of kindness, whilst culture change is 1 million subversive acts of resistance. And what's interesting, and that really resonated with me, because these are almost like micro resistance, a form of micro resistance that's taking place. We are pivoting, we're shifting mm-hmm. the point of departure for people to understand what is contextually normalized within right. the community. And so the Letters Project allows these things to exist because we need to talk about trauma. We need to be able to have a place to indulge in vulnerability and accept yeah. vulnerability as something that isn't rooted in cultural norms or social conditioning. It's very much just you existing as you are, experiencing what you're experiencing, and hoping to connect and resonate with another person. It's like yeah. humanity at its finest.
I think that word connection is so important, because even though we can feel so surrounded by our family and our friends, so on and so forth, you can also sometimes feel so isolated by whatever you're holding on to. And a lot of that is because you might not necessarily see that narrative or see that story out there in the world, because no one talks about it. And I think something like the Letters Project allows people to kind of see those narratives, those experiences, somewhere, and realize, oh, I'm not alone. Someone out there has gone through this trauma. Someone out there has experienced what I am experiencing.
Definitely.
And that gives you hope almost.
Yeah, definitely. You
know? So I definitely think that's something that's much needed. And what about the Banat Collective?
So Banat Collective was started by a amazing curator and artist by the name of Sada Safwan. Mm-hmm. She started sort of this because she also found that there was a lack in or a cultural gap that took place in the community where we needed a space for to discuss the notion of womanhood and the female mm-hmm. experience and the intersectionalities that exist within that. Within the MENA region, because yep. when you talk about underrepresented or marginalized communities, being a woman and being within that kind of framework is definitely something that is on the periphery that needs to be brought to the forefront.
Right.
So Banat Collective is about that. And so she's the founder and curator, and I'm the co-curator. I've been brought on board as a co-curator where we're working on a project together for an exhibition tackling the preconceived notions of what a woman is, called the mystical woman. And so how do we define or redefine what a woman should be with all the like notions of fetishization, mm-hmm. objectification, and how do women within the MENA region see themselves, and how can they begin to unpack and dismantle those ideologies? And how can they reframe and provide a counter-narrative to the existing one?
And I guess, what do you... My question... And there are so many questions that came out of that.
Go ahead. We've got all day.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of, first of all, what are the... Because it's a collection of essays, if I'm not mistaken, right? That were submitted?
So the first part is the middle of it all, which was an online publication that mm-hmm. brought stories of the coming of age.
Right.
But now what Banat Collective is trying to expand on is an actual exhibition of artwork.
Artwork.
There will be, you know, ranging from installation to performance to paintings to actual written essays. So you have this sort of full range of the female experience documented in these creative outlets. And then that will hopefully translate into an actual exhibition, but then also alongside feed into a podcast, feed into many different things.
And what about women who will just say, listen, I'm fine with my narrative. My life is just freaking dandy. Stop trying to deconstruct it.
Yeah, and that's perfectly fine. Yeah. But I think, one, we cannot ignore that the narrative that has been set for us has been given by the patriarchy and has been given by an overarching voice. And I think what the what Banat Collective does so brilliantly is that it provides alternative answers or solutions to a larger problem, which is that there are many voices. There is a range and a diverse and rich culture that exists within the MENA region, and the underrepresentation of women needs to be brought to the foreground because it needs to be for women by women.
Right.
And so that's what it's about.
Many voices need to be represented. Do some voices matter more than others?
No.
So how do you know which voices are you going to represent?
It comes from what is the overarching framework and what is the overarching message. I think if there is a need to discuss a certain topic, it depends on whatever that visual exploration or creative outlet is going to be. So if I, once again, it goes back to that barometer, like where do you measure you know, the female experience, or where do you measure, for example, toxic masculinity? You know, is like a simple, you know, handshake something?
Because I'm asking because you're the one who's you're co-curating this exhibition, right? So technically speaking, you and the co-founder are curating this, so you would be deciding what voices, I guess, are more highlighted. So I'm just wondering how you go about that.
Well, actually, the way we go about it is that we narrow down strong, because as artists and curators, we are able to very quickly identify what is a strong piece of work. And that comes from like visual execution, conceptual thread and how it's being relayed, how the message is overall being conceived and perceived.
Okay.
And that goes through like a very standard list of like design and art principles. And then you go down that list. So that gets narrowed down. And then once that's narrowed down, that's taken into an advisory committee, which is involved with people from all walks of life, some people that aren't artists themselves.
Okay.
And so from there, we shift the conversation. So it's multiple voices being able to see the overarching framework that perhaps would either be overly like exhausted through people who are creative lenses and they just want to show their lens and whatnot. But I think the alternative gaze is very important. So, and then from there, we will kind of narrow it down.
Yeah, I was just wondering, because I mean, I'd assume there would be a bias if it was just kind of two people kind of picking out the narratives or the voices that are shown.
We work really hard to make it as inclusive as possible. At the end of the day, nothing in life can be 100% inclusive.
Of course, yeah.
There has to be some kind of some kind of not restriction, but constriction maybe. And so we kind of go through this filtration process, which allows us to look at it from the inside out, but then very much the outside in.
Okay. So, well, you're doing a lot of interesting work, but looking at your life now, how is it different than what you expected it to be like 10 years ago when you were, when you had, what were your expectations like versus how it's turned out, I guess?
Well, to be honest, I didn't really have many expectations. And that's because I truly believe in the power of now and this idea that I cannot really be greater than myself unless I believe in something greater than myself.
Even 10 years ago?
Yeah. I mean,
wow.
And so I always knew that there was a reason for me to be in that particular moment. And there's like, for example, there's a reason why I'm sitting here right now opposite to you in this very moment. And the way that my life has planned out is exactly the way that it had to be.
Do you feel your priorities were different 10 years ago versus where they are now in terms of where you focus?
No, but I think that I have been confronted with more obstacles along the way. Mm-hmm. And I think I could have made a choice where conformity could allow me to relinquish and remove those obstacles. Mm-hmm. But I am not very much a person that I follow the beat of my own drum, mm-hmm. and a nonconformist. So I very much, the way that my life has panned out and where I am now is exactly where I need to be.
Okay. So we're going to be talking about how people define you. Mm-hmm. What makes you qualified to have a discussion about this topic?
So interesting. Even the way the question is phrased, I was just like, I don't like the way this question is phrased. I am, the fact that it says like, what makes you qualified to be defined by others. Not only that, but it puts a discourse or conversation in a position where you use the power of seniority to define where you sit within that conversation.
So I'm not here to qualify you. I'm just asking you to tell the people.
And for the people, I say, this is what I think. No, but I mean it. And there never needs to be a justification why people
are having a discussion
about you. Mm-hmm. I mean, point blank, period. If it's about you, you are not just the narrator of that discussion, but you are the subject of that story. So you by default have the qualification to discuss it. So yeah, but anyways, so yes, the answer is I am qualified.
Full stop.
Drop the mic, walk away. Yeah.
I like that. Okay. So thank you so much for joining me on today's episode. We're about to jump on to the topic side of things. Thanks to everyone for listening. You guys can find all the links to where you can find out more about Sada in the episode description. You can also hear the rest of our discussion about how people define you on Wednesday. So make sure to subscribe wherever you're listening if you're not already, so that you don't miss anything. As always, I love your comments and messages, so keep them coming. This is Imshad Ahnazi signing out. Bye, guys. We'll be right back.